WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we've been featuring some of our favorite interviews with writers from our archive. We conclude the series with Stephen King, one of the most popular writers of our time. As usual, he's on the bestseller list, this time with his book, Hearts in Atlantis. In June, King was nearly killed. He was walking along the shoulder of a rural road in Maine near his summer home when he was struck by a van. His hip was dislocated, several ribs were broken, and his right leg, knee, and hip were shattered. He's still recovering and in physical therapy, but he is writing again. In fact, a new book about writing is scheduled for publication next September. I spoke with Stephen King in 1992 after the publication of his novel, Gerald's Game. As the book opens, a married couple is in their forest cabin. They're ready to play their S&M sex game. She's on the bed, her wrists are cuffed to the bedposts. He's undressing. She realizes she's tired of this game. It seems stupid, ridiculous, and corny. But she can't get her husband to stop, and that makes her furious. As he forces himself on her, she kicks him where it hurts most. He collapses, suffers a heart attack, and dies. And she's alone, cuffed to the bed, in the middle of the woods. Now the horror really begins. I ask King what made him think about how corny sex games can be.
Actually, Gerald's Game started with the concept of the woman being chained to the bed. I'd written a book before where a woman and a small child were stuck in a car that was sort of surrounded, if you will, by a rabid St. Bernard. That book was called Cujo. And essentially, what a lot of that book was two people in a very small room, although it did have a shifting perspective so that it went to other characters. And I thought originally this was the takeoff point for the book. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had one character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to sort of consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very snidely whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book.
Well, you do in a very funny way. I mean, the husband says to his wife as she's handcuffed to the bedpost, he says, "I'll teach you me proud beauty."
Yes, exactly.
Pronouncing beauty the way the landlord in a bad Victorian melodrama might.
You can almost see him waxing his mustaches, can't you?
Right. Let's get Stephen King to the kind of gore and terror and suspense that you create. There's a scene in Gerald's Game, your new novel, that I'd like you to read from. And this is a scene in which the wife is still handcuffed to the bedpost. Her husband is laying dead on the floor, and a stray vicious dog from the area has walked into the house and has started dining on the woman's dead husband. Would you read it for us?
I sure will. Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog's licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up from their puffy sockets at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. "Let go of him," she told the dog, but her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with the disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel. His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmarish situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. "You bastard," she said in a low, trembling voice. "You cowardly, slinking bastard."
That's Stephen King reading from his new novel, Gerald's Game. Do you think of yourself as having taken the horror novel to a kind of more physically explicit place than it had ever been before?
Yeah, I think that to some degree I did do that. I think probably I've been surpassed in that area by some of the people who've come after me. I'm thinking mostly of Clive Barker,
yeah.
Yeah. But you realize that when I started reading and experiencing horror, some of it that I was reading and experiencing came from a very graphic wellspring. And I'm thinking about the horror comics of the 1950s, things like Tales from the Crypt and the mm-hmm. Vault of Horror that can now be seen on home box office. And at the same time, I was discovering horror movies. I usually went by myself in the afternoon to the Highway Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which is still there, incidentally, and saw things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, or I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, or whatever it happened to be. And it was there that I started to see that it might be possible to combine some of the classic elements with some of the things that I was seeing in the schlock press and the schlock movies.
When you would see movies like this, did they scare you or just amuse you?
No, they scared me. You have to remember that we're talking 10 or 11 years old, and even with a picture like Teenage Monster, where the flying saucer appeared to be a cool cigarette filter tip with a sparkler stuck in it, that it looked real to me because I was at a young and very credulous age. And one of the other things that I sensed as time went past and I got a little more discriminating in my ability to detect special effects, if not necessarily my sense of taste, was that when I wrote it, you never saw the zipper going up the monster's back, that when the imagination was in charge of special effects, they were always perfect. As perfect as the book was, anyway.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about being scared when you were young?
I liked the total surrender of emotional control. It was very important to me, and I would almost be willing to say sort of a lifesaver. I'd been raised in a family where emotional control was a really important thing. You weren't supposed to show you were afraid. You weren't supposed to show that you were in pain or frightened or sad or happiness was permissible as long as it didn't go too far, because then one might be considered to be almost insane if one got too happy. So that emotional control was, you know, sort of a requirement. And all the movies, my brother, David, was crazy about Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin. That was his emotional release. It's all a form of emotional seduction. And for me, the terror was what really appealed to something that I think is probably just inside people, that there isn't any logical way to explain it. But I loved it, and I loved giving up that control.
We're listening to a 1992 interview with Stephen King. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1992 interview with Stephen King. To write the kind of fiction that you do, you really have to think about how people respond when they're terrified and how they deal with pain. How they deal with pain and with fear and terror. Do you handle pain well, and has that ability ever really been tested?
You know, I don't think anybody knows how they deal with pain. Everybody's pain is so individual. And so we have no basis for comparison. I think that pain is really the ocean that's between us. You know, I think it was John Donne said, "No man is an island." But in fact, I'm sorry, John, but we are. And when you're dying of cancer, you do it alone. And when you have migraine headaches, which is something that I'm prone to, you do that alone. But if I have a really terrible headache, what I call one of my headbusters, I wonder how that would stack up against someone else's pain. But I don't know, because there's no way to tell. There's no valid basis for comparison because we don't feel each other's pain. The interesting thing to me, more interesting than pain in my life or the comparative levels of that sort of thing, is that experiences about pain and experiences of extreme terror, I think, make it possible to see the world that we live in, the mundane, everyday world, in much greater detail. Small things, unimportant things, stand forth in a way that they don't. My experience of being under tremendous stress, physical stress or emotional or mental stress, is that things that otherwise just sort of fall outside what we think of as the tunnel of perception, our tunnel vision, kind of spring forward again, and I see them all over again. For me and Gerald's game, some of the most interesting passages, there's one section where this woman has to get a glass of water off a shelf, and in another one, she realizes that because she is handcuffed to the bed, she can't quite get the glass to her lips. And what she does then is, for me, was one of the most interesting and challenging parts of writing the book, not because it's an adventure, but because it uses very prosaic, everyday things to make suspense. And so it makes us look at them again and say, oh, what is that? And that's the experience, it seems to me, of brand new perception, of childhood, that sort of reaction of, oh, look at that. And maybe the adult doesn't see that thing at all.
What have been your greatest moments of terror in which you've experienced this kind of heightened perception?
Gee, I think probably for me, I think probably about 4 years after my wife and I were married, we were living in a little western Maine town called North Windham, and there'd been a snowstorm the night before. And my daughter Naomi was about 3, and my son Joe was about 1.5 years old. And they had a snow shovel, and they were shoveling off the porch. And I was putting library books in the car because we were going to go to the library. And I heard my son cry out. And when I turned around, he was lying face down in the snow, and my daughter was standing beside him. They had gotten a hold of the shovel, and each one was trying to pull it away from the other one. And my daughter's grip had slipped, and the shovel had come back and cut him severely with the corner in the face. And when I picked him up out of the snow, he appeared to have no face. It was just blood from the hairline to the chin, with one eye staring out of it. And I was convinced that he was going to die. And if he wasn't going to die, he was probably going to lose one of his eyes. And I remember not knowing what to do. But beyond that, I remember very clearly how the sun made all these little tiny sparkles, millions of sparkles off the snow. And I remember very clearly running with him in my arms into the house to use the telephone, and the way the blood splashed in these droplets like coins on the hardwood floor. These are memories that are very clear in my mind, and their clarity stems directly from the fact that, you know, I was over the moon with terror.
Your son healed well?
He did heal well, yeah. He has a little tiny scar. It severed the optic nerve, but they were able to sew that back together. So he sees, and everything's fine.
Wow. So
The optic nerve. They couldn't have fixed that. It severed the tear duct.
Huh. Were you already writing when this happened?
Oh, yeah.
Like publishing?
Mm-hmm. I'd published Carrie at that time and Salem's Lot. 2 books. I was 2 books into the job at that point. That's a lot of years ago.
After having experienced something like this and experienced the terror of it, how did you feel about going back and writing about this kind of physical terror? Did you feel like now that it had happened to your family, you should kind of back off a little bit?
No, I don't think so. I don't see any correlation between the writing and my daily life in this sense. I don't think that the writing of terrible things serves as some kind of magic hex symbol, like on a barn door. You know, the way that the Amish put the hex signs up, and the idea was to keep the bad luck out of the barn.
Mm-hmm.
They were very religious people. They are very religious people, but that's never stopped them at all from the hex symbols. No more than it stops an atheist, you know, from tossing salt over his shoulder when he spills it. But I never saw the act of writing about terrible things as a way to hedge my bets, a kind of supernatural throwing Saul over my shoulder. Nor did I ever think that writing about stories of terror would in some way, you know, cause those things to happen.
When you started publishing your novels, and people started reading them, and people who you knew understood more what went through your mind, the kind of thoughts that you had, did people start to see you differently?
I think so. There was a sort of, I won't say pulling away exactly, but a kind of, you'd see a kind of question in their eyes, sort of like, where are all the bodies buried, Steve? or there would be this sort of casual, by the way, Steve, what was your childhood like? Were you ever beaten? Did they burn you with cigarettes, or what was it? And I would say, really, I'm just like you are. And then they would step away.
That would be the worst news.
Yeah. Basically, all I'm doing is saying things that other people are afraid to say. The job's not much different than being a comedy writer. Basically, you say, what is the one thing that nobody wants to talk about that everybody will sort of raise their hands in horror? Well, not everybody, because you never get everybody, but what can I say that will be the literary equivalent of taking a fork and scraping it across a blackboard, you know, or making somebody bite in on a lemon? And when I find those things, generally the reaction from the readers or the people even who see the films is one of, thank you for saying that. Thank you for articulating that thought.
Your story, Misery, was about a psychotic fan who tortures her favorite writer, because he's let her down with the plot of the new novel.
Mm-hmm.
and you, in a way, have become a kind of magnet for a few kind of crazy fans. Was the story of Misery based on one particular fear or one particular incident?
I don't think so. There are a number of things. Yes, I've been a lightning rod for a certain number of crazy people. We keep files on them. They are constant correspondents, and they want to be infinitely, intimately involved with my life or the lives of my family or whatever. Or they believe that they actually wrote the stories, or that you're picking their brains telepathically or whatever it is. And you begin to realize the power of fans. And of course, it's just interacting with them, there is a kind of fan psychology that, for the object of that fan adulation, gets to be really, really uncomfortable sometimes. They want your autograph. They want to tell you how much they enjoy their stuff. And if you say, look, I'd love to sign your books, but I can't right now. I'm taking my family out to dinner, or I really have to be over here. Their reaction is, go to hell, you son of a bitch. You know, just like that, it changes.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening.
So you sense in the people who are the most devoted fans this really sort of churning need to identify emotionally or psychologically with the object of the, you know, the fan worship. And sometimes this actual resentment, this feeling of, you have what was really meant for me. In the best of all possible worlds, I would be you. And you see this quite often in the mail. So there's a lot of times this adulation, and there's this really uncomfortable undercurrent of resentment at the same time.
Stephen King recorded in 1992. The new movie The Green Mile is based on one of his books. His next book, which will be about writing, will be published in September. We hope you've enjoyed our series of interviews with writers. This is Fresh Air.